Just a light drizzle now, 35 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm so pleased to once again be sitting opposite Dr. Art Sear, who is the single most frequent guest to the morning show and has been a faithful partner of the morning show for decades now. And I look forward to each and every opportunity to sit down with Dr. Sear and talk about a host of different topics and issues and concerns. I know that many of you read his columns very, very regularly. They appear in newspapers all across the country, including right here locally in the Kenosha News and Racine Journal Times. And he is also author of the book After the Cold War. And Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, Professor Berg, thank you very much.
Great to have you here. I think the place we are going to start is actually with the topic of your most recent column, which I don't think has yet been published. I think it's about to be published, but and this is the column that concerns Henry Kissinger, who, of course, recently passed away at the age of 100. And I have to say, I learned a tremendous amount looking at your column about a man whom I thought I understood decently well, but it really is a long, complicated life and legacy.
Yes, indeed.
At one point, you say, Henry Kissinger, master strategist, successful policy leader, dedicated public official, ruthless power player, disciplined author and scholar, relentless publicity seeker.
Well, that's for sure.
That's a really interesting list. And of course, that last part I found really, really striking. And you actually don't dwell a lot on that last point in your actual column. But I wondered if you would just kind of say a word about Henry Kissinger's relentless appetite for publicity and at least generally how that tended to play out.
That used to be heard, that's no longer heard as far as I can tell at all, was dedicated public servant. And the image, especially from the New Deal, when our government activity expanded tremendously and stakes were high during the Great Depression and highest during the war, the self-effacing man and woman who served the public good in Washington, D.C., that was kind of the General Marshall, who certainly was well-known, but not a man who sought publicity. Kissinger was relentless in cultivating the press from a young age. His first book was Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy in the 50s, the result of a Council on Foreign Relations study group, what used to be the center of tremendous influence in foreign policy until Vietnam in New York. And that got him on the cover of Time magazine. That does not happen naturally. It became required reading in the Eisenhower White House. The president was very much aware of him. And during the Nixon administration, despite the tremendous pressures, obviously he had enormous energy. He would spend almost every day, a chunk of the day, dealing with the press and cultivating them. And he was not married at that time. He remarried shortly thereafter, while he was Secretary of State. I can't remember, but he was he got a lot of publicity, including in the society pages and the gossip columns and scandal magazines for dating older guy, dating a wide range of mostly young starlets and actresses and Jill St. John. And it was pretty, it was a different time, of course. But presidents tend to like the self-effacing, dedicated public servant. Nixon, who has a very bad reputation, especially on people who circulate in and around public radio and television, Nixon was remarkably tolerant of this. Nixon was really a complicated character, but he took an amused interest in Henry Kissinger's social life. Richard Nixon ran foreign policy, whatever some of you, our listeners, may think. And he was quite tolerant of Henry getting a lot of publicity and taking a lot of credit.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, we're all complicated, aren't we? And you brought up that dimension, so we're talking about it. I'd like to move on to more serious things.
Of course, absolutely.
Kissinger had a huge impact on policy.
Of course.
Just tremendous. And as did Nixon, and it endures.
Right. I want to actually hone in on something in particular when it comes to the way that Kissinger worked with Nixon. This is something you say in your column. Henry Kissinger became Nixon's national security advisor.
Yeah.
And you say Kissinger transformed the position into a powerful center of policy implementation, not just advice.
Yeah.
Tell us more about exactly in what way that was true and how he accomplished that.
National security advisor is not in statute. The National Security Council is, which was part of the tremendous organization and reorganization of the government during and after World War II for dealing with foreign policy. Excuse me. And military types tended to be the early national security advisors under President Truman. I'm sorry, if I'd known you were going to go this way, I would have done some homework on the NSC. It became more structured, much larger and more structured, more formal under Eisenhower. And he had two national security advisors for planning, Gordon Gray, a Republican Boston banker, and Robert Cutler, who were in the news. You know, people knew who they were, but again, it was not a faceless but a low-profile position. Since we're on NPR and given the temper of the times, Bobby Cutler was gay, which was just a fact of life back in those days. And
interesting.
That was just part of life. It wasn't politicized and dramatized like today. They oversaw very, very extensive discipline planning under Ike. And there was a general, Andrew Goodpaster, who was, like Marshall, very much the dedicated public servant, and he took care of implementation of foreign policy. There was tremendous criticism, especially from academic and intellectual circles, of the formal structure under Eisenhower. And basically, in plain English, nothing went wrong for 8 years, which is actually pretty phenomenal in hindsight, and one reason, a good reason why Ike is seen now as such a great president. Worked like hell, and large numbers of people were working. But we need to be more assertive, more aggressive in the world. Communism was on the march. Today, we, for all our problems and difficulties and crazy activities and our government and political system, the U.S. is pretty secure. We are on the offensive against Russia and China for all practical purposes. It's a reverse in the 60s. Mm. And the monotony of the Eisenhower administration provided an opening for John Kennedy in particular. We need a more assertive, more exciting government. He collapsed the Eisenhower committee system into a much leaner NSC. Hmm. And there's a lot to be said for that, I think. But Kennedy wanted to be involved in foreign policy. It wasn't monotonous at all. As we all know, with hindsight, it became very exciting. He picked McGeorge Bundy, a very youthful dean of the faculty at Harvard University, who was only around 40, like the president himself. And Bundy was a more visible figure. He wasn't the publicity hound like Kissinger. But these people tended to be more well-defined and media-conscious. And Kennedy, to his credit, much like Nixon, they had been friends when they were in Congress in the 50s. Hmm. They went to Cuba together without their wives in the 50s, you know, the odd couple. It's fascinating. Anyway, I can go on and on. But after all the problems of the 60s, there was an effort to make a larger structure under Kissinger. Bundy was an advocate. The record's clear on Vietnam especially. He and others at the top were advocating intervention in 65. But generally, he saw the job as advising the president and doing so privately. And Kissinger really, given his talents and I think it's fair to say genius in the policy area and in foreign policy generally, he really became an active implementer of policy. The Secretary of State was sidelined by design. Nixon did not trust a lot of people. He didn't trust the State Department. And Phil Rogers, the Secretary of State, who in fact was a friend of Nixon's, a Washington lawyer type, more than a policy person. Nixon and Kissinger quite ruthlessly sidelined him and the State Department. It was a great meeting of the minds. The advisor has been important, and I'll stop with this, because the president needs someone he can trust and someone who reflects what he or she, I carefully add, and I'm sure it'll be true soon, what they want. And Eisenhower is sizable and, in hindsight, brilliantly run, large NSC staff. Kennedy's more flexible approach. Kennedy and Bundy were very professionally, not personally, they're very, very similar in their style at work. Walt Rostow and LBJ, and it goes on. It's become continued to be a visible position because the president is so much involved in foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And the way it's involved, it's the president's man or woman and remains rather visible.
Right.
Excuse me.
And Henry Kissinger played a really big role in,
yeah, unique,
in what
I
that
think.
Role is now. Yeah,
yeah, unique in terms of policy implementation. And they were remarkably effective in a very turbulent time. Man, the Republicans, in fairness to Nixon and Kissinger, they walked into a mess in Washington in 1969. And I'll stop there. This is turning into the academic lecture that I try to avoid here.
I think it's fascinating stuff. I am reminded, as you're talking about Kissinger and Nixon and how they worked together, a moment from a interview that I shared in the podcast over the weekend because of Kissinger's death was an interview with historian Neil Ferguson, who did a long interview with Henry Kissinger that was transformed into a really fine documentary for National Geographic, as a matter of fact. And one of the things that came up in our conversation was how, and one of the things you hear in this documentary is excerpts from some of the phone conversations and other private conversations between Kissinger and Nixon, and just how different they sounded from each other, and just the way they expressed themselves, the way they used language, They just sounded like they were cut from very different cloth in a lot of different ways, and yet, in many other ways, of course, they were kindred spirits and probably saw the world the same or had many of the same values. And it was just fascinating to me to think that, I mean, sometimes when we think about a good team, we think about like Thing One and Thing Two in the Dr. Seuss book. I mean, who are almost indistinguishable from each other. And some effective teams, the dissimilarities are an important part of the chemistry that makes teamwork work.
Yeah, human relations are endlessly fascinating, as Shakespeare and so many others have pointed out. And I think one of the most insidious aspects of policymaking, especially foreign policy at that time, but domestic as well, is that we can quantify things. We can use statistics. We can use quantitative analysis to handle and analyze policy. Nixon and Kissinger were too intelligent and too able to be seduced by that. But it became quite dominant during the Kennedy and Johnson years. And it continues, certainly in the private sector, but also in government.
Right.
I find it I don't like it.
Yeah. One other thing about Kissinger I think we should talk about, and by the way, we could endlessly debate all kinds of specific points about the policies that he put forward and so on, but...
By all means, let's do so.
Right. That would eat up the time, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
No, I actually wanted to ask you about something else.
We'd lose listeners quickly.
Yeah, right. Your column mentions some of the essentials of Mr. Kissinger's background, including where he was born and raised and the fact that he and his parents fled Nazi Germany, I think, in 1938. And he fought for us in World War
II
and so on.
Absolutely. As did Nixon.
Right.
Absolutely.
I just wonder, the circumstances of Kissinger's early life, I wonder... What is your sense in terms of the man he became, and in particular the kinds of things that he did on behalf of our country? How much of that do you think was shaped by that early experience of fleeing Nazi Germany and so on?
Of course. Nixon and Kissinger were both outsiders. Economically, they started out with no advantages in doing homework, scrambling to do homework for this column. I learned Kissinger sold, he was going to school, and then in free time he would sell shaving brushes in the streets of New York City, a classic immigrant study, and then he would study at night, and of course did extremely well. But they were both outsiders. Foreign policy is the preserve of the upper class, the aristocracy, the elite, in other countries, and historically, and to a profound degree, and until Vietnam, the upper class. Very much ran foreign policy. They populated the Foreign Service. Very decent men from not only the Ivy League, but also old money and prep schools and even the social register. Lots of exceptions to that. Bundy was the personification of Boston Brahmin, but Bob McNamara grew up in Oakland, California. A lower middle class family. Dean Rusk grew up in the Secretary of State. McNamara was the Defense Secretary then. The Secretary of State, a man I admire a lot, Mr. Rusk, he was from poverty in Georgia.
Wow.
But the rank and file and most senior people, Dean Acheson, in the Truman Administration, Cordell Hull, through most of FDR's tenure, it tended to be the old upper class, and Nixon and Kissinger were outsiders. And there was inherent insecurity and inherent drive, but also appreciation for being in the United States of America. Classic patriotism, which I applaud. I'd like to see the American flag more, including on college and university websites nowadays. And they both personified that. They had to fight against a lot of opposition and maneuver. Nixon was seen as the outsider. Eisenhower picked him carefully as vice president, but there was always resentment among the old financial elite in the Republican Party, which got Ike the nomination in 52. You know, he's this plebeian from the orange groves in California. We really should be having good old Nelson Rockefeller, who's a member of the club at the top. We're a lot more egalitarian today, and because we are, we tend to overlook... Even in serious studies, these important social distinctions, especially in the Republican Party.
Right.
But in the Democratic as well.
Sure.
The old Southern aristocracy versus people coming up in the South.
Yeah.
Neil Ferguson did a book on Kissinger, which I recommend, and a very good obituary on Kissinger. I can't remember where I saw it. It may have been the Wall Street Journal or it may have been the Atlantic Council website, but look him up. His first name is N-I-A-L-L, I think.
That's right, N-I-A-L-L, Neil Ferguson. And yes, he was actually hard at work on that biography when he did these extensive interviews that ultimately were the fuel for this fascinating documentary.
Exactly.
That once in a while still shows up on the National Geographic Channel.
Yeah, no, he's a very serious person. He's also very much a media operator, but he's a serious writer and scholar.
Absolutely.
It's well worth your time. Hmm.
For those of you just joining us, we are spending today's morning show with Dr. Art Sear, who visits us quite frequently on the morning show, and we've just now been talking about the recent death of Henry Kissinger at the age of 100, and his complex life and legacy is explored in Professor Sear's most recent column, which should be appearing in newspapers this week. Maybe we can just drop in at least a brief mention of another recent death, that of former First Lady Rosalynn Carter.
Yep.
I don't know if you had the opportunity to watch any of the services that were on television and so on, but I found myself profoundly moved by what was said about her and her dedication and spirit of service. I just wondered if you had any thoughts about Rosalynn Carter.
Well, sure. I first became aware of Jimmy Carter when I was in the Army. I spent some time at Fort Benning, Georgia in the early 70s going through the infantry officers school, the basic course. My branch was intelligence, but part of that is you had to go through the this particular infantry training. And he was the governor. And I was and am very much a northerner, although the U.S. Army is a southern institution, and it was a tremendous education for me.
Mm-hmm.
At a big army base, there's not a lot to do unless you're really into various vices, bluntly. And I watched TV a fair amount, and it was not a very happy time for our country or for me. And Carter, that was the governor at the time, and he was this remarkably intelligent, articulate leader, and I became tremendously impressed by him, and I supported him personally in 76, and I still do in many ways. It's very much a mixed blessing and mixed bag as president, but I was profoundly impressed by his integrity and his commitment to public service. He and his wife were close partners, very close. She came to cabinet meetings, which was a source of some alarm by the media and others, and I thought that was all very silly. I don't believe she, unlike, say, Mrs. Reagan, she did not interject herself into personnel and personality matters. But they were very much a team, and he would send her. I did take a look at his autobiography as I was scrambling around early this morning, sir, and after I got your email. And he would send her, as well as his mother, overseas to the tremendous pressures of the presidency or something he emphasizes. And they're certainly there. Every minute counted, he said. So he would use both her and his mother, which I think is fine. It's a very Christian thing to do, and he was a very dedicated Christian, although some purists objected about diplomatic protocol. But they were truly a team and worked together in everything. First ladies often have a separate existence or a distinctive existence, Betty Ford and substance abuse. Eleanor Roosevelt had a separate and very complementary career. But with Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter, it was very much a close team, very dedicated, and very impressive to me, just phenomenal.
Yeah. And speaking of impressive, I must admit that I just find so profoundly moving the sight of, you know, for instance, every living First Lady.
Yes.
Sitting in the same pew and with a couple of their husbands there as well. But, I mean, as a mark of respect and appreciation for all that Mrs. Carter did on behalf of our nation.
Yes, absolutely.
In another recent column, you actually look back at John F. Kennedy.
Oh.
And the occasion, of course, was the 60th anniversary of the tragic events in Dallas. And one of the interesting things in this column is at one point you quote the veteran CBS journalist Eric Severide saying apparently this is something he said not too long after Kennedy's assassination, that most likely Kennedy's most significant legacy will be one of attitude, that, I mean, just kind of the general spirit of optimism and so on that he helped to engender. And it's clear from your column that you agree with that and that you think that's important. But you spend some time in your column, you're making us understand that Kennedy was a whole lot more than just a confidence builder, that in fact, there are some substantial things that he managed to achieve in his brief presidency.
Yeah. He got us through the Cuban Missile Crisis. His blunder at the, and it's not excessive or unfair, his blunder at the Bay of Pigs, and publicly he agreed with that. He took the blame and did not point fingers in the usual Washington way, and I think that's admirable. He learned a lot. It was a very quick study. And after the Bay of Pigs disaster, which is one of the big failures in American foreign policy and history, during the missile crisis, his missteps helped encourage Nikita Khrushchev to take the terrible risk of putting long-range nuclear missiles into Cuba. And Kennedy, it was terrifying at the time, but the more we learn, the more we realize just how close it was. If Kennedy had given into this enormous pressure, he stood alone among his advisors, not just against the military brass, but just about everybody wanted to invade Cuba right away. It was such a huge departure from the status quo. And we know now if we'd invaded, there would have been a nuclear war. And I can expand on that. But that was definitely a great president when it really counted then. But we also have the Peace Corps, which many laughed at the time, and is tremendously durable and a great positive force in the world, and also the right positive image for the U.S. The Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of 63 was a direct result of the missile crisis and his and Khrushchev's agreement to let's collaborate to make sure we don't have this kind of thing happen again. Important trade authority, which resulted in the Kennedy-Tokyo and Uruguay rounds, trade liberalization, the foundation for this steady expansion of globalization today. Much to the consternation of Democratic Party liberals, he insisted that the Communications Satellite Corporation be a private corporation, chartered by the government, but they've got to be private, which was quite a real departure from the status quo of that time, not just in the Democratic Party. And that laid the foundation for the tremendous vital role of private industry, spearheaded by the always interesting Elon Musk, and interesting and brilliant and effective business executive. And I could go on and on. And his wife, as well as Mrs. Johnson, gave great emphasis to beautification of the country. In the case of Mrs. Kennedy, high tone to culture. Again, after the monotony of the 50s, it was what a lot of people wanted. And she was a very distinctive personality in terms of style. I hope this is clear, I'm old enough to remember that time, and it was quite inspiring, although President Kennedy also was struggling with a lot of problems and a lot of challenges at the time he was murdered. He went to Texas because he didn't want to go. It wasn't at all clear he was going to get reelected in 64. He only became the great hero for a while after his horrible death. But the Texas Democratic Party is not where he wanted to spend his time.
Right.
But it was going to be close. We did, it's, as I keep returning to, because it's important, public insults, sleaze, public, what we have is a public obsession with sex and sleaze today, and denigrating public figures. That was not part of that earlier time. And I think he and his wife reinforced the importance of a positive outlook on public policy and the world. I hope that's clear.
Yeah,
thank you for asking about him.
And I really loved, in a sense, kind of the closing thought of your column, which, and I can't remember who you were quoting. Somebody was...
Galbraith?
Yes, I think Kenneth, John Kenneth Galbraith was in some sort of press conference or Q&A or something, was asked about John F. Kennedy, and you describe him kind of brightening at that point and saying, Jack Kennedy was the most curious, questioning person I have ever met. Kennedy made you think.
Yeah.
Actually, I think... I can't tell if those are Galbraith's words or your words at the end. Kennedy made you think.
Well, that was my phrase, but Galbraith, that crystallizes what Galbraith said.
Yes.
He's pretty much forgotten today. It's interesting. He was very prominent publicly in the 50s and 60s and thereafter, a public intellectual, which we don't really have in the same way anymore. He was a very prominent Harvard professor who wrote a book called The Affluent Society in the 50s. We've got to start paying attention to the poor in this country. They're kind of they're kind of ignored in the current environment. And Kennedy made who was surrounded by intellectuals, great and small. Kennedy made him ambassador to India, where he was very successful. He was a very tall man and very imperious at Harvard and elsewhere. And we would get him at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations regularly. He would always draw a very large crowd. He was a rather monotonous speaker, but very interesting, but very imperious. I used to tell our hardworking, small, mostly young staff at the council that, remember, in this business we deal with the great, the near great, and the end great. And also that think of him as the poor man's Charles de Gaulle. And that's the way it was. But when I mentioned Kennedy at this small dinner, which were important for us for fundraising, there'd be a big lecture, and then we would very carefully plan these smaller events, he really became animated. And it really brought home to me personally how JFK impacted people. For a minute, he became a regular guy and really, really friendly.
Interesting.
Well, the importance of leadership, isn't it? Interpersonal leadership.
Right. Well, and beyond that, I think even if one is not necessarily a leader of any kind, just lifting up the quality of curiosity that Kennedy, I mean, when Mr. Galbraith thought back to Kennedy, I mean, the first thing that he said was how incredibly curious Kennedy was, curious and questioning and so on. I'm reminded of a moment from the show Ted Lasso. I don't know if you've ever seen this this show about an American soccer coach who's coaching in Britain and kind of a fish out of water, a real down home attitude and so on, but who achieves amazing success despite the doubts of everybody around him. And there's a really interesting scene in which someone has very arrogantly challenged him to a game of darts. And just assuming that this bumbling American doesn't know anything about darts, and as he's throwing these darts with a surgeon's precision, this character Ted Lasso says, "I've been underestimated all my life and was bullied a lot when I was young, and I don't know. At some point, I figured out that those bullies, they weren't curious about me. They just wanted to judge me."
Yeah.
And then he quoted Walt Whitman. I don't know if it's correct or not, but supposedly Walt Whitman said, "Be curious, not judgmental." Those power, and then at that moment, boom, he hits the bullseye and decisively wins this darts match. But I mean, what stays with me is this idea that maybe one of the cures to the ugly times that you talk about in two different columns, actually, that maybe one of the keys out of that highly divisive, judgmental place we find ourselves right now is to try to foster more genuine curiosity about each other. I mean, about the people on the other side of the aisle and why do they think the way they do or do the things they do or talk the way they do. And anybody who embodies the power of curiosity, it seems to me, is really giving us an important human lesson.
Yeah. What's the other person's point of view?
Right.
Crucial to success and business and every other aspect of life.
Absolutely.
And it's the antithesis of focusing just on the numbers and just on the data.
Right.
And thinking that you're superior because you have greater skill in this area than others.
Right. Or just gravitating to your kind of immediate gut reaction to something that's different and, you know, maybe not your idea of how things should be. So,
well, I'm glad it had such a positive impact on you. I must say this is really interesting listening to you.
Yeah. So, curiosity is needs to be king or queen, needs to be more a part of our lives. For those of you just joining us, we have with us in the studios Dr. Art Sear joining us to talk about a host of different things. And I don't think we have a lot of time to touch on this, but I do want to acknowledge the beautiful column you wrote about our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln, and his connection to the Thanksgiving holiday. I think this is something you actually have rightly written about before because it's really, really important. But but among other things, you know, as you are talking about Mr. Lincoln and his legacy, I think it seems to me the central point you were making is that Lincoln, for pursuing these transcendently important goals of reuniting our country, was someone with astonishing political skills. I mean, so he had to wed the practical with these huge ideas that would seem almost impossible to achieve. So I guess I appreciated your appreciation of Mr. Lincoln because we sometimes think of him kind of simplistically.
Yeah, no, nor maybe our most complicated president and endlessly complex and a little hard to grasp in full. Sarah Josepha Hale was the editor of Godey's Lady's Book, G-O-D-O-Y, I think, or G-O-D-E-Y, which was really big in those days, G-O-D-E-Y, Lady's Book, and it was nationally very important to women. And the home. She had written a number of presidents over many years asking for Thanksgiving. So she should get the credit. On October 3rd, 1963, the White House issued the Thanksgiving Proclamation. Lincoln finally implemented it, declaring the last Thursday of November to be a day of thanksgiving and praise to our beneficent Father who dwelleth in the heavens. The proclamation also requested, quote, the interposition of the Almighty hand to heal the wounds of the nation and to restore peace, harmony, and union. He linked it to his consistent goal of reintegrating the South. Let's keep in mind we're one nation, and we've got to eventually put behind us bitterness and this tremendous hatred between North and South. By the fall of 63, finally, the Union was clearly starting to win after years of losing. The Battle of Gettysburg in Pennsylvania was the last time a very large Confederate army was able to invade the North. And at the same time, Grant took Vicksburg, this crucial port city on the Mississippi River, after months of maneuvering, battle. It's a phenomenal and brilliant and mind-boggling exercise in strategic genius. And at that point, as someone said in Victorian fashion, the great Mississippi now flows unvexed to the sea.
Unvexed.
From that point on, it was clear that the Confederacy was finished for those who were serious and focused on the details. In the fall of 1962, when we were mostly losing, in the East at least, there was a victory at Antietam. The Union Army it was inconclusive, but the Union Army remained in charge of the field. And after that battle, Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, which is a very complicated legal exercise, not at all emotional.
You call it a dry document.
Yeah, a legal document dealing with property, which might be offensive to us today. But Lincoln used it to free the slaves in the South. The war was no longer just about national union, but about the moral issue of slavery. And he left the North alone. Constitutionally, he had no authority. Confiscation acts passed in 1862 by Congress, driven by the White House, authorized Union forces to seize Confederate property, and African Americans were defined as property, all of which might seem quite crude to us today, but Lincoln was dealing with a mind-boggling array of competing forces, including in Washington. And it was a brilliant way. I urge people to look into it because it's too complicated to really explain on the radio. It was a brilliant way for him to develop cohesion in the North and make the war about moral issues above all else, while not alienating the border states, which were crucial, including his own Kentucky and Illinois, which is not a border state, but Southern Illinois almost left during the first part of the Civil War, without antagonizing these people who were neutral or pro-slavery in the North. Just a phenomenal exercise.
Incredible.
I mean, he really was. He had to be a genius. It's just extraordinary how he was able to juggle so many ideas and competing forces brilliantly.
Right.
Yeah, no, don't underestimate this man. We, in our cynical time, there's a school of younger historians in the U.S. who are now very down on Lincoln and feel the radical Republicans are the force that really should have prevailed during the Civil War. Utterly absurd to me, quite understandable given the temper of our times, but really look into Lincoln. You'll learn a lot. It'll help you in your daily life. It'll help you deal with your own problems. Just an amazing carry. It's almost like divine intervention that we had this guy when we really needed him.
Right, yeah.
When things were really bad for us Americans.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Really bad.
Thank goodness he was.
Thank God.
Be thankful, yes. We have just a couple of minutes to touch on something that was quite eye-opening to me. A recent column you wrote about President Biden meeting with the leader of China. And in writing about this this important meeting, you tell us, in effect, that China's economy is really experiencing some serious challenges on, it sounds like, on a whole lot of different fronts. And it sounds like maybe at the heart of it is just the fact that that China is trying to engage in capitalism while retaining, you know, the kind of the strict controls of a communist dictatorship. And so
quite right.
So it's like a strange marriage, maybe doomed from the start. But just how rough is the China's economy right now?
There's a lot of turbulence and turmoil in the economy because, as you said, you summed it up, they're trying to have the benefits of a capitalist economy since 1992. And Deng Xiaoping's Declaration of People's Socialism, they've been working very effectively to draw foreign investment. And there's a tremendous amount of capital still in China, but it's fleeing. There are masses of young people, including inherently dangerous young men, who just can't find work. Massive youth unemployment. A housing bubble has collapsed. We know about that in the West, given the financial crash of a decade ago. Lots of bad loans, lots of corruption. They execute people who are found guilty of corruption in China quite readily, but it speaks volumes on the nature of their system. But they're finding it very unmanageable. Xi Jinping is a very dedicated fanatical communist and an egomaniac. He's put himself in the Constitution recently. Think of how humiliating it is for him to go all the way to a suburb of San Francisco to meet with capitalist President Joe Biden. And so at some level, it was a rather degrading exercise, but they've got to maintain collaboration with the U.S., and I think it's great, given the fact the deterioration of relations. I think the Biden administration and predecessors deserve credit for pursuing a range of economic and military alliances that in a much larger and more complicated geographic space that in many ways are like the alliance systems mm-hmm. and economic agreements that we put in place to contain the Soviet Union during the Cold War.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's the larger train of history, as Kissinger might say. The Soviet Union is gone. Japan was supposed to be taking over the world a few decades ago. Mm. They're still there, fortunately, but no longer seen as a competitor to the U.S. And the same thing is happening in China.
Wow. One thing you say about the Biden administration is that, in contrast to the Trump administration, you say that the Biden administration, when it comes to China at least, is engaging in what you call serious, methodical diplomacy.
Yeah.
I mean, versus, you know, kind of a slapdash, headline-making approach. I mean, it's hard work behind the scenes trying to forge exactly the connection that we want with China.
Yeah. One of our outstanding graduates, an advisee of mine, Christina Wright, who has become, she's not a Foreign Service officer. She's a contract employee of the federal government, but has now years of experience on working with the State Department primarily on the Organization of American States in the UN. She's zoomed in, thanks to my colleague Jeff Roberg in political science, a few weeks ago, and she talked about the continuity of policy. Even she was talking off the record to students. She said even in the more orderly, normal state of affairs in Washington or the chaos of the Trump years, policy tends to be continuous. And in terms of guarding strategic technology against China and punishing Chinese commercial espionage and industrial espionage, there's a lot of continuity between the Trump administration and the Biden administration.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciated all that I learned about the state of affairs in China. It's amazing how little we read about that in mainstream media. I mean, they're obviously a really significant presence in the world. And so anyway, I appreciated you taking the time to write about that.
And they are consistently becoming very more and more aggressive concerning territorial expansion in Asia. By no means am I trying to say that they're not a menace and an irritant and in important ways a danger to the United States. All the more reason why Biden and Xi got together, and they had practical arrangements where the Biden administration, I believe, has had some notable successes in the world, and focus on these things because the president himself, given his age and limitations in terms of media skill at this point, takes a lot of heat.
Mm.
I don't underestimate him in terms of the next election. Biden and Xi agreed, as the article mentions, on drug and law enforcement cooperation, which is their weakness, gives them an incentive to pursue this, and also high-level military discussions, which were terminated within the last few years, are the both militaries are going to start talking to each other again, which is extremely positive and important.
Great. Well, it's nice to have positive things to talk about and to appreciate. And I'm afraid time has gotten away from us, so we will not have time today to give you a chance to weigh in on the ouster of George Santos from the U.S. House of Representatives.
What a shame. Okay.
Well, I would be curious to hear what you have to say, but that will have to wait for another time.
Well, and, maybe next time. I'll be back. Thanks to you. I will be back. Thanks to you. I'll be back.
Very good. We look forward to it. Dr. Artsir joining us today here on The Morning Show. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Likewise. Thank you, my friend.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I look forward to a conversation with Doug Instanis from the Racine Theater Guild. The Racine Theater Guild's current production is the musical The Little Mermaid, which actually opened last year and so is back with many of the main cast members returning. And we'll talk about the challenges of this complicated score tomorrow on The Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at our website, wgtd.org. It's going to be cloudy today with a rain-snow mix on and off. We'd expect essentially no accumulation. A high temperature today of 37 degrees. Cloudy overnight with a low of 28. By tomorrow, we should have sunshine and a high of 41. And look at this, Thursday, mostly sunny and a high of 53 degrees. News is next. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News and